Hi guys, nice to be with you. Today I'm going to talk to you about the most scandalous book of 2023, Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy by Kostin Alamariou. Some people think he's the man behind Bronze Age Pervert, whom you might have heard of. So if I read to you from the back of the book, you'll get a sense of what the thesis is, because he states it many times, he states it quite clearly, and here's what it is. I'm going to tell you, and then we'll see what's the big deal about it. Why is it interesting? Why is it scandalous? What does it mean? And how can you start to think about it? This book, he writes, is an attempt to show that the aristocratic regime and aristocratic morality is the origin of the idea of nature. That at the point at which a historical aristocracy starts to decline, its defenders, in abstracting and radicalizing the case for aristocracy in the face of its critics, come upon the teaching of nature and the standard of nature in politics. It is precisely this teaching of nature, so corrosive of all convention and all morality, that is politically explosive, and that explains the deep connection between philosophy, the criminal study of nature outside the city and outside the myths and pieties of the regime, and tyranny, the criminal and feral regime of rule outside and above all law and all convention. Okay, so that's the thesis. I'm going to try to explain that to you, but we have to start from something very basic. Nature, what are you talking about? Aristocracy and nature, what does he mean by that? Like, a lot of people, when they hear nature, they think what? I like to be out in nature. The trees, you know, the mountains, going for a hike, and all of that. Nature walks. Well, that's one way to think about nature. That's how we think about it now. You know, I see a beautiful tree, I love nature. But there's another sense where nature is to be thought of in contrast with convention. So there are some things that are by convention, and there are some things that are by nature. What's an example of something that's by convention? Whether you drive on the right or left side of the street, for example, in your car if you drive. Okay, that's a convention. That's not natural. You could imagine a situation where it's flipped, and I'm sure you know of some situations that are just like that. Okay, in this country, you do it like that. In another country, you do it like this. And so there's always been a question in the history of political philosophy about whether certain laws and practices, customs and all of that, are merely by convention, or whether there's a natural standard, okay? But you have to get the first distinction between nature and custom. So there's an argument, Leo Strauss makes this argument, and Strauss is an important source for this book. There's an argument that philosophy begins with the discovery of nature. That means not the discovery of sticks and stones and rocks and trees and rivers, but with the discovery that there's something other than convention, something that we didn't make. And all kinds of questions come up around that. For example, traditional belief in gods. Are the gods merely conventional? Or standards of justice. Are standards of justice merely conventional? So you have not just the distinction between the natural and conventional, but the superiority of the natural to the conventional. And therefore, a question, as he puts it here, philosophy is the criminal study of nature outside the city and outside the myths and pieties of the regime. Why criminal? Why outside? And why outside the city and outside the myths and pieties of the regime? Because if to be a good citizen is to follow the law, to believe in the law, to believe that the law is just, to believe what the law tells you is true and all of that, but at some point you begin to doubt whether the law is by convention or by nature, then somehow by that very fact you put yourself outside of the authoritative legitimacy of the law and of its beliefs, of its quote myths and pieties, and you begin to study what's true by nature. Okay, so when Socrates did that, it ended up leading to his death. He was accused of corrupting the youth. As you may know, he was accused of not believing in the gods of the city. And he was found guilty, sentenced to death, and killed. An event that became one of tremendous significance for the history of philosophy and for the history of political philosophy. But the philosopher is not the only figure who breaks with custom or convention in order to try to put himself into a kind of correlation with the natural, or who tries to study nature, or who tries to transcend custom and convention. There's also tyranny, which does that. Tyranny, which puts itself outside of convention, above all law, which breaks through the dominance of custom. So one of the scandalous ideas of this book is that there's a kinship, a necessary kinship, between philosophy and tyranny, that they are, as it were, twins. They were born from the same set of conditions. Those conditions are what? The breakdown of the rule of custom. But we have to see a little bit more precisely how that happens. So in the first chapter of this book, Alamariu, he says that the original social form, the first society basically, was what he calls a fundamental democracy. It was totally dominated by custom. And the question is, how within a society that is totally dominated by custom, can there be introduced the principle of a break from custom? So, think about it. You don't have the discovery of nature, precondition for philosophy, or as Strauss said, philosophy begins with the discovery of nature. You don't have the discovery of nature unless you have a weakening of custom and of custom's hold on your thought and on your practice, on your what you do, what you say, what you think, how you live. But where does that principle of a break from custom, how is it introduced? Where does it come from? So he first says, it might look like there are figures within the closed society of fundamental democracy with the totalitarianism of custom who sort of get some distance from it. For example, the shaman, the magician, since after all, they seem to manipulate natural forces, and they also seem to have a knowledge that is different from, distinct from, elevated in comparison to, the knowledge of the rest of the people. And so they seem to be a kind of possible prefiguration, but they culminate in the idea of a sacred king, and what Alamariu argues in chapter one, using the works of Fraser and other sociologists, as well as other points of reference, is that even the sacred king is bound by all kinds of customs. So it doesn't really actually affect the break, the radical break, without which you don't have an explanation of the birth of philosophy. So what does he say? He says that, in fact, you need to posit, and in fact, he does his best to show this and to demonstrate it, a foreign conquest. When an aristocratic conquering people takes over the fundamental democracy, when it overruns them, when it conquers them, then you have introduced into the body politic the set of conditions that allow for the break with custom. What are they? Well, first of all, just by virtue of the fact that you have a ruling class, a foreign ruling class, a conquering class, the conquering class can use the conquered class for all of the labors of mere life. In other words, on the basis of the conquered people, the conquering people have a certain leisure, a leisure that lends itself to intellectual activity, to science, to philosophy, to study. They're able to separate themselves from just working, just subsisting, bare life, mere life, that kind of thing. Okay? So that's one consequence of the imposition of a conquering people on a conquered people. But another one is that the conquering people, they come with some specific virtues. They come with the virtue of courage and deliberation, which they needed in order to be able to conquer successfully. So this is important because it, for him, starts to set the groundwork for thinking about the virtues. Why, when the Greeks thought about human excellence, did they think of the virtues? And why were these two central ones for them? Courage and prudence. In deliberation, they're not the only two. There's justice, there are other ones, wisdom. But he says you can begin to get a sense for why the Greek virtues developed the way they did, because they are, in all places and in all languages, the virtues of a conquering people. So in order for there for an aristocratic society to become a conquering people over a fundamental democracy, not only did it need to have, not only does it produce this leisured class, also not only does it introduce these military virtues, but it also had the custom of the Mannerbund or the war band, young men who are kind of like a pack of wolves who live outside of the city and who are sort of free to roam and to learn what they need to learn in order to become successful conquerors. And in Alemario's presentation, this institution, the war band, the Mannerbund, it inherently facilitates a break with the dominance of custom because these people live on the periphery. They break with the city. They become roamers. They become like wolves, okay? Pack of wolves. So he says, number one, the stratification of society. Number two, this principle of the war band is important. Okay. Another thing he says is that an aristocratic society is one that typically, and I won't give you the full analysis, but this is an important point. It's one that practices eugenic breeding among its flocks. Okay. Aristocrats have experiential knowledge in the practices of selective breeding as concerns their animal stocks, their flocks, and all the rest of it. And their familiarity through that with the principle of a biological nature, blood, body, okay? Nature not as an abstract concept, nature not as the rocks and the trees, but nature as a vitality of life, an intensity of life, but in particular, as this biological bodily excellence, one that can be developed through a program of breeding and eugenics. So, in short, the preconditions for a break with custom are made manifest only under the conditions of aristocratic conquest of fundamental democracy. Okay, so that's why if I go back to the thesis on the back here, this book is an attempt to show that the aristocratic regime and aristocratic morality is the origin of the idea of nature. But now we have to add something here, that at the point at which a historical aristocracy starts to decline, its defenders in abstracting and radicalizing the case for aristocracy in the face of its critics come upon the teaching of nature and the standard of nature in politics. So I got to say something about that very briefly. So the aristocratic regime isn't just by virtue of its thinking about nature in terms of selective breeding, and its thinking about the break with custom in this other way, it doesn't automatically become philosophical. It doesn't magically become philosophical, okay? But what he does show in the second chapter is that the pre-philosophical notion of nature in an aristocratic regime, again, has to do very much with body, blood, vitality, intensity of life, a certain embodied excellence, one that becomes manifest or is revealed through the qualities of its most most intense exhibitors. Okay, so he spends chapter two looking at the odes of Pindar in praise of certain aristocratic athletes in order to show, again, what was nature for the aristocrats prior to the philosophical conceptualization of nature. It was bodily vitality, life, intensity of life. So you look at an incredible, beautiful, strong, vigorous, healthy, outstanding athlete, and that person has more nature than somebody else, okay? More intensity of life, more being, as it were. You could say that person is more real if you wanted to use the language of reality. If you know Plato's cave allegory, you've got the shadows on the wall. Then gradually you go see the objects that are casting the shadows on the wall. And then gradually you go up to the outside of the cave where you see the things themselves. And then you see the idea of the good, the sun. Now, that has one interpretation and one context in the Republic. And Heidegger has something to say about it. But consider that all of those various phases and stages from the shadows on the wall up until the most beingful beings and the very idea of the sun, the idea of the good, the figure of the sun itself, consider that those were intensities of degrees of intensity, vitality, and life, so that some people in their existence are like shadows on the wall, and some people in their existence are like the blazing bright sun. And that's degrees or extent of nature. You could really say that for the aristocratic pre-philosophical regime, nature is that intensity of life. And again, his goal here is to show that those people who talk about the link between the origin of philosophy being the discovery of nature, they sometimes treat nature in its conceptualized or abstracted character and forget that the abstracted, conceptualized notion of nature was preceded by, is informed by, is essentially related to this pre-philosophical, aristocratic, biological, vital interpretation of nature. So that's another scandalous thing about this book, not just that it links philosophy and tyranny, but also that it links philosophy and biology. Philosophy and a non-egalitarian account of the reality of human existence, where somebody's existence can be more real, more intense. In the fullness of a human existence, that's how nature becomes manifest. In the paucity or lack of human intensity, somehow those people are not even fit to be considered human, maybe. Okay, but for sure the eugenic, as it were, dimension is there, the biological, the vital, all of that. So chapter one, the fundamental democracy, rule by custom, introduction of the aristocratic principle, and how that begins to set the stage for a break from custom, one which apparently could not have been accounted for just within the primary fundamental democracy, the first society. Therefore, you needed the foreign conquest. Chapter two, Pindar, the pre-philosophical notion of nature, showing the bodily dimension of it and this notion of intensity and all of that. Chapter three is on Plato, on Plato's dialogue, The Gorgias, in particular. Okay, in particular. And the point of that chapter is to show that even in this Platonic dialogue, there's a figure called Callicles, and you have Socrates. And Socrates is typically thought, let's say, a lot of readers who read that dialogue say, Callicles is the voice of tyranny. He's the voice of, like, laws are for weak people, and strong people should transcend the law and do what they will. And, you know, really like the Nietzschean voice of rebellion against law and morality and the assertion of will and strength. Okay, I'm just trying to give you an impression here in case you've never read The Gorgias, and so that we don't have to go into all of the details. There's a element of Callicles, the figure representing that. It's sort of the tyrannical, translegal option. And Socrates is thought to be like the refutation, the moral refutation of tyranny, the defense of justice against the attack on justice as merely conventional. Okay? And what chapter three is designed to show, in a nutshell, trying to be short and sweet about it, is that there's an agreement, if you read Plato correctly, between Socrates and Callicles about the kinship between philosophy and tyranny, in that Socrates agrees that both philosophy and tyranny are concerned with the well-born or the well-turned-out natures, with those young men who have this particular intensity of life. And he recognizes that that particular intensity can become expressed in a break from custom either through philosophy or through tyranny. And therefore, if philosophy is concerned with the best natures, it must also recognize the possibility that the best natures can express themselves in a tyranny. Best nature in the sense of an intensity that breaks through the dominance of custom. So Alamariu shows in chapter three that even Plato's Gorgias teaches us that for Plato, there is this kinship between philosophy and tyranny, and it's a kinship based on the recognition of nature, understood, as it were, in that aristocratic sense. But Plato carefully and cautiously masks the tyrannical potentials of philosophy, through Socrates' speeches, but in a way that shows you Socrates and Callicles are nevertheless akin in their concern for the intense nature, the vital life, since that's what can become a philosopher. They don't care about the average, middling non-entities. They care about the potential philosophers who, ipso facto, are potential tyrants, okay? That's a big part of the argument there. And I will just add that I liked this part of the exposition. I learned something from it that I thought was valuable. He says that Callicles believes that you can appeal to these potential tyrants, get them away from the dominance of convention, somehow merely through rhetoric. Whereas Socrates shows, and in this sense he's superior to Callicles, that you must take into account not merely rhetoric, but also force or violence. And what's the connection? What's the link? What puts everything together? Socrates does say, and Callicles does not say, that what's very important is the politeia, the regime. Politeia is the word, by the way, that's translated as republic in the title of Plato's Republic. You must take into account the politeia, and the politeia is a combination of persuasion and force. Okay, so Alemario reads this as a sign of the superiority of Socrates' approach. Socrates and Callicles agree as to the kinship of philosophy and tyranny. They agree as to the goal of protecting the better natures, but Socrates sees what Callicles doesn't see, that mere rhetoric is not enough. Okay, and the sign of that is his invocation of the centrality of the politeia or regime. So that's very nice. And then in chapter 4, the book shows how these themes are present also in Nietzsche. Okay, that there's a preservation of the aristocratic origin of the notion of nature in Nietzsche. There's a preservation of the fundamental insight of the kinship between philosophy and tyranny in Nietzsche. And in discussing that, he also can say a little bit about the similarities and dissimilarities between Plato and Nietzsche. Similarity, concerned with the better turned out natures. Similarity, understanding of the relationship between philosophy and tyranny. Difference, Plato tried to have an exoteric teaching, a mask that preserved morality and that preserved convention in a certain way. And Nietzsche is much more brutal, even though he himself wears a million masks, in unmasking that moral veneer. Why? Because Nietzsche seems to have thought, in the presentation of chapter 4, that Plato's moral veneer over the threatening and dangerous side of philosophy culminated in Christianity with a moralism that completely forgot about the goal of protecting the better natures. And in order to restore philosophy's central task, Nietzsche had to destroy the moralism of that veneer. He had to undo the success of Plato's rhetorical project, a success that culminates in Christianity and in the harms that, for Nietzsche, Christianity has done to philosophy. You see, so it's like a big kind of project. And that's it. Okay, there's an appendix on Strauss, because as I mentioned, Strauss is an important figure in this book. He's referred to often, he's discussed often. Alemario doesn't follow him in every point, and at times he goes out of his way to say, here's what Strauss got right, and here's what he didn't, or here's what he said, and here's where I go beyond what he said. Simplest case I can tell you is that Strauss doesn't really talk much about the eugenic dimension of classical philosophy, not so expressly that he ever would have titled the book Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy. In this sense, you could say Strauss was much more Platonic in trying to make sure that the dangerous elements of philosophy were understood, but not necessarily front and center, and he didn't see that it was appropriate to talk about them in a loudspeaker. And you could say that Kostin is therefore much more Nietzschean, but okay, that may not tell you much, because there are all of these subtleties between Kostin, Strauss, Nietzsche. And in my view, it's worth keeping in mind as you read this and as you think about his argument, not only the figures who are explicitly on his mind, but also somebody who, in my opinion anyways, we should include in any conversation about the nature of philosophy, about the birth of philosophy, about the relationship between philosophy, thought, and politics. And by that, I mean Heidegger. So even though you won't see a chapter here on Heidegger, and even though, as best as I can recall, you don't see Heidegger's name mentioned in the main text, though he is there in the footnotes, these are the kinds of questions that are always worth thinking through with the help of all of the best guides that we have. Strauss, without a doubt. Plato, needless to say. Nietzsche, fully admit it. And I say we add Heidegger, and we can round out the picture and just help us to think about the nature of philosophy in relationship to politics and the body. So there you go. That's like a quick overview of Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy, the most scandalous book of 2023, written by Costin Alamario, reputed to be the man behind Bronze Age Pervert, though I don't know, don't comment. And it's an interesting suggestion. Make of it what you will. I think even without that, the book is well worth reading on its own merits and for its own arguments. Especially if you are a reader of Leo Strauss, you may enjoy this. But if you are a follower of Nietzsche, you may also learn quite a lot from it. And if you're somebody who thinks that there's like an unbridgeable gap between Plato and Nietzsche, you may also enjoy this. If you're one of those young men who is nihilistic with respect to the boring, incompetent, and in some cases, a deranged and delirious ruling bureaucracies and administrators, and who are attracted to the new findings of biological science about inherent qualities and differences between groups and all of that, if basically you are a young right-wing, how would you put it, anti-liberal, you could also learn from this book. What you learn is going to be something that is out of the control of anybody, but God, I would say, it's between you and the book, what you come out with and an encounter with it. But I would say that the significance of this book, among other things, is that it reminds us not only of the centrality of philosophy in the best human life, but of the fact that you can't just take philosophy for granted. You can't just treat it as something ornamental or, how could you put it, flaccid. That if you're in the realm of thinking about philosophy, then you are presented with all kinds of fundamental problems, problems of the intensity of a human life. Oh, sorry, I left something out that I should say. Excuse me. I definitely left something out. So you have the aristocratic regime, but as I said, that's not yet philosophy. Okay, it may have a notion of nature, it may have selective breeding, it may have discovered certain preconditions, it has a sense of the intensity of a human life, but it's not yet the philosophical notion of nature. So one of the things he says is that, sorry, I thought I left this out, when an aristocracy begins to decline, and you get a lot of this in the Nietzsche chapter because Nietzsche seems to have caught this point. When an aristocracy begins to decline and the aristocratic customs begin to lose their hold, then there will be a corruption of many of the people who were previously held together by the aristocratic custom. But some free spirits or some genuine natures will, at the moment of the collapse of the aristocracy, have their energies freed. And in freeing their energies, they will try to recapture the nub, the heart, the essence of aristocratic life, of the aristocratic regime, namely the notion of nature, but now in a conceptualized or abstracted form. And the discovery of nature, in that sense, the philosophical discovery of nature, the preconditions for the philosophical discovery of nature, are not only the presence of the aristocratic notion of nature, but also the collapse of the aristocratic regime, therefore the weakening of aristocratic custom, and the attempt at salvaging the aristocratic notion of nature through its conceptualization. So philosophy saves nature. Philosophy is concerned with the salvation of the aristocratic notion of nature in the conditions of the collapse of an aristocratic regime. Okay, that's, anyway, another piece of the puzzle. So I haven't told you everything there is to say. This is not a substitute for reading the book. Okay, you have to always go to the primary sources. Then reading this book takes some effort because you have to read it carefully and you may want to see whether all of the interpretations of the other figures are correct. But my goal here was just to give you the gist of it. Okay, the gist of it. So that if you read the book, hopefully this is a nice first step for you, a helpful preparation. And if you don't read the book, hopefully you took something away from this brief overview anyway. So there you go. Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy. Kostin Alamariou, Bronze Age Pervert. I don't know. Like, share, comment, subscribe. Let me know what you think. And as always, don't forget to visit millermanschool.com for courses on political philosophy. Thanks, and see you in the next video.